And now, it's time for Miss WeedWiki Speaks. You're listening to Miss WeedWiki, and I'm here today with my guest, Rena Ramprasad, who's founder and owner of the High Society Supper Club, a company that produces cannabis-infused dining experiences. Thank you for joining me today, Rena. Could you tell our listeners, please, where you're joining us from?
Thank you so much for having me, Khadija. I am calling in from Hamilton, Ontario today, Canada.
Love it. How's the weather in the Hammer right now?
It is cold. To me, it's freezing. As a Caribbean girl, it might as well be minus 50. So I know it's spring, but it sure doesn't feel like April today. That's for sure.
I hear that. Well, thank you again for joining us on this brisk morning. My listeners and I would love to know more about you and your cannabis journey. Could you tell us all where it started?
Sure. So I've been around ganja my whole life. I saw my grandmother making salves and things like that. My father always smoked. But it wasn't until I was older, started back smoking as an adult, where, it became a very kind of like a spiritual thing for me, for my mental health, for my overall sense of well-being. I started sharing that with friends and started making like brownies and things like that for people. One thing kind of spiraled and led to another. And eventually it led to High Society Supper Club, which is where we're at now.
I hear you. What's it like being a pioneering woman of color in the Canadian cannabis scene?
Oh, wow. Well, I don't know how much I can say about myself being a pioneer. But I can say that I definitely was one of the first around for a long time. I noticed that there weren't many people or any people that looked like me in the space when growing up. To me, ganja seemed to be a very cultural thing. I don't remember white people really engaging in it much when I was younger, other than maybe telling my dad he was doing the wrong thing or making derogatory comments. I remember, having to hide as a teenager smoking and, even for my early adult life. But I'm glad to see that things have definitely changed. The tides have changed. Those who maybe were smokers before, closet smokers, have come out, and the world has not only changed their attitudes, but just woken up and recognized, what that was all about. So, it's been great. It's been great. I feel blessed to have been included in a lot of circles, super blessed to have been given the opportunities that I have. I'm certainly not rich or, I'm not, any heavy hitter right now by any means, but I do believe that I've had some influence, at least opening some minds and helping to create and stir some thoughts here and there. And I feel I express and feel a lot of gratitude for, being included in that space. And I in all honesty, it wasn't like I was really invited to a lot of places. I would find out about things and felt like, we needed to be represented. So I just kind of show up and, try to be a part of whatever, and kind of created a space for myself. In the beginning, I used to speak to a lot of deaf ears, but I'm glad that, I'm not going to take any credit for this by any means. There have been many, many, many other voices that have been much more amplified than myself. But, all of us have definitely made a difference. And I think helping people to recognize that this industry is so much more than about just making money.
Tell me more about your heroes in the Canadian cannabis space. Who do you look up to?
Oh, yeah. You know what? There are definitely a few. A good friend of mine, Ashley Atthill, who's the first Black woman LP, big props to her. She's certainly, she's faced a lot of battles herself as well. She has been out there. It's not She wasn't handed her position by any means. She worked very hard for it. And just like myself, you know, had to have a lot of one-on-one difficult conversations with people out there who, you know, really try to dim your light or, you know, try to run you over, maybe because they come from a place, you know, of, you know, where they expect to be, you know, offered maybe more privilege or whatever. I know she's dealt with some of that, a lot of that as well. So, you know, I give her giant props. So many people, I give you guys big props. I love what you're doing. Like I said, you know, you're the first ones to do it. And it's been so necessary for so long. Like, you know, sometimes being the only melanated person in certain circles, you kind of carry the torch and you have to wear a lot of hats and you bear a lot of responsibility. And so, you know, I've been lucky, like I said, and blessed to be able to be invited and use certain platforms for my voice. But there's been so much more that I've been wanting to do, you know, like the list is books long. And, you know, I don't know if I'd ever get to any of them. So seeing, you know, these things being done and carried out because their necessities are so important. So props to you guys for doing what you're doing. And I know that you'll elevate, you know, Black women's voices and, you know, give a space for that because that needs to be heard. So that's huge. And gosh, like just so many, like all of the pioneers, my friend Tracy Curley, honestly, my friend Tracy Curley, who battled so much and didn't get, you know, her just due. You know, unfortunately, she ended up passing due to her illness, but, you know, was one of the first people on the front lines to battle, you know, misogyny and racism as a white woman. You know, stood up and was saying stuff. I remember reading a post from her once and was shocked to find out that it was a white woman that posted. This was before we were close friends. And, you know, so to see people like that step out and really show their allyship is, you know, big to me. In Canada, let's see. You know, I honestly have to say we haven't had a ton of advocates. You know, big, large advocates, social justice advocates, maybe until recently, which is great. You know, I can't say a lot of our, you know, super founding people were the biggest advocates, you know, because they had enough to fight already with cannabis being, you know, such a, you know, discriminated against, you know, way of living and so much more. But, you know, gosh, just off the top of my head, like lots, there's a lot of people, you know, there were a lot of people featured in, you know, a Now article with me, you know, Black people who are also doing, you know, very innovative things and smashing ceilings and what have you. But yeah, I think just overall, you know, there's a lot of unsung heroes in this industry, like a ton of them. You know, my friends at Organja who are, you know, kind of, you know, unfortunately we end up being left with very little resources. And they're one of the few that are fighting for the cultural rights within the industry. You know, there aren't many people that are talking about, you know, what about our cultural aspects? And, you know, all of that's kind of been washed away and commercialized and stolen and, you know, I hate using the word appropriated really, but yeah, it kind of really has been, you know, and all over the place. And they're reminding people of the authenticity of our peoples and those who have brought it here, and not just that, but who have paid the price and who are still paying the price and are still, you know, being shunned on the sidelines because we're not wearing white lab coats. And, you know, maybe, you know, these are people who are not interested in maybe, you know, networking with, you know, the white men in suits and what have you, and, or, you know, finding a place for them to fit into that system and their society that they created. Again, you know, these are folks, you know, we're people who come from ganja. We kind of have our own ideals as well, you know, and how it's fit into our lifestyle all of this time, you know. Rastafari, you know, has a whole other discipline in terms of, you know, how ganja is incorporated into life and their lifestyle. And it's just, you know, so many aspects of it, you know, like even children. I grew up with it being normal for, you know, children to be around it. I was a child around it. It wasn't a bad thing. It's this society that's created that. So yeah, you know, there are lots of unsung heroes, definitely around in Canada and around. Yeah.
Well, thank you. I'd love to enlighten our listeners because we have a variety of listeners that are newer to cannabis, especially, you know, the base being our Afro-Canada Bud Sisters, right? And one of the things I'd like to explain for them is, and I'd love your insights about what the government got wrong with legalization. So let's start with, could you define for us what is the legacy market to you today?
So today, legacy would be, you know, anybody, I won't just say people who were there before, but like pretty much anyone who's had ties to the industry prior to legalization, essentially, is what legacy would on a broader spectrum be defined as. To me, it goes even deeper than that. You know, those who have been in it generations deep, you know, those who, you know, have built their families and households and raised their children on this and have lived with the risk of potentially having all of that snatched away in a hot second because somebody else, you know, didn't yet understand or hadn't yet graduated to that frame of thoughts, you know, or, you know, because someone else was above the curve or ahead of the curve. So, yeah, legacy is pretty deep. It has some cultural ties to it as well to me. But, you know, for a broader definition, essentially the people who were there prior to legalization, who created the industry and paid the price as well.
Yeah. Yeah. How would you describe how the Hamilton legacy scene, like pre and post legalization?
Yeah. So pre-legalization, legacy was booming. It really was. You know, it's always been tough. It's always been a risk. Coming close to legalization as it became a little bit more accepted and mainstream and what have you, legacy really experienced a boom because, you know, not only was there an increase in demand, but I guess, you know, to some extent, we were almost led to believe that, you know, this new industry was going to be inclusive of the people who had built it. You know, it's almost like that's what had been alluded to. You know, there were tendrils and warnings that, you know, well, you're going to have a permit and this and that. And so people were like, okay, yeah, bring it on. You know, we'll pay for permits. We want to pay for permits just like any other business. We want to be treated like any other business. Only to find that, you know, once legalization came, it actually was a model that was very different than anyone was, I wouldn't say necessarily expecting because I can't say I was surprised, but that they desired less than what they desired. So, you know, created a big wall and certainly had put in place all of the protocols necessary to make sure that you separate the, you know, the legacy market, which obviously are folks who are going to be limited in resources because you're talking like small business versus, you know, conglomerate corporation type folks. And that's what we're dealing with. So, yeah.
Yeah, no, you're describing it well. And let's be honest, with legalization, did we have any indications? Did you get indications from the government that there was going to be any social equity policies built into it?
Well, it seemed, okay, so there was nothing indicating that they were even interested. Sorry, another cannabis hero of mine, Anna Maria Ananager, who's a friend of mine, the founder of Cannabis Amnesty as well. She's not even really a cannabis consumer much, but she's someone who recognized the injustices and as one of the country's most kick-ass defense lawyers recognized that there needs to be some awareness brought to the government. The government was putting in place a lot of regulation and policy to help benefit the new booming business industry and aspects of this new realm, but no one was addressing all the BS that had gone down, you know, like literally the year and month prior and all of the decades prior, you know, and the fact that the people who were passing these laws were the same people who were condemning these people who were carrying these actions out prior. And, you know, so anyways, no one was acknowledging all of the wrongdoings, but they were happy about this new multi-million dollar industry that was about to spring about without correcting the wrongs that had been done. So, you know, she created the Campaign for Cannabis Amnesty. And this is something like, you know, I've been so upset about this because I've seen people throughout my life be accosted for their usage and worse. You know, I know people that have lost their life, you know, for this bull crap. And, you know, there was a lot that needed to happen. So they weren't addressing anything. No one was really bringing much up. You know, a corporation here and there might make a comment, you know, for the sake of maybe, in my opinion, you know, getting them more likes or boosting them on social media or boosting their popularity or making them seem like they're, you know, CSR was more in line, or they were a little bit more politically correct or aware or concerned, you know, so people were making little comments, but really and truly there was not much care or concern going on until I would really credit our campaign for bringing a heck of a lot of awareness. We originally started asking for 10,000 signatures and that came very quickly, came out of effort. You know, we attended a lot of rallies. We were in person. We spoke to thousands and thousands and thousands of people. You know, some people didn't even know it was an issue. And, you know, there were a lot of people we had to convince too. You know, people who are not affected are so lucky. But a lot of folks were unaware. They were like, wow, this is what's going on. Oh my gosh. Like, how is this allowed? And we're like, yeah, well, how is any of this allowed? But so there really was no awareness, not much. I shouldn't say no. There wasn't much awareness. For those who were aware, there wasn't much action happening. You know, our campaign certainly stirred a lot up. We asked for expungements for small cannabis offenses. The government didn't see it as enough of a profound wrongdoing, you know, which is something that we're still taking up. You know, we're still working on a bunch of stuff, but they came back with expedited pardons for people, which is a little bit better, which means that they were going to pay for people as well as help speed up the process, but it's still not great. So, you know, in short, there wasn't a lot of socially conscious stuff. And I apologize, you'd asked me about the scene in Hamilton prior and, you know, post-legalization. So prior, it was booming because people thought they were going to be embraced. And then when legalization happened and they found out like, oh, shit, nope, we're not being included at all. Actually, it's in favor of the conglomerates and folks who have money already and, you know, whoever they want to favor. And people realized that they were out. And they came down like gangbusters and were busting people left, right, and center. You know, most of the legacy folks had to get out because they weren't doing this for fun. This is how they were feeding their children. This is how they were paying their rent, their mortgages. So, you know, people had to go and protect themselves and do what they had to do. So it's definitely taken a major dip. You know, I don't diss anyone who supports the legal market because this is what we asked for. This is what we asked for. We asked for the legal market, but it's still not where it needs to be. So I would be the last person to ever say, you know, just go fully legal. I still say, you know, if you can shed a little money to the legacy side until things are equal, do that. You know, I still say support legacy. I still say it. Because the legal side will be supported. There's a lot of people who don't know legacy and they want to go into a store. They don't want to go to, you know, I'm not even going to say any names, but they don't want to go to who they used to deal with before, who their friend, whoever, whatever, what have you, or even, you know, an online site or whatever, because they have these misconceptions and perceptions and whatever and blah, blah, blah. That's fine. Okay. It's great. Go into a store. I have no problems with that. You know, there's the regulated side. Great. And much more Black people now. We have at least like 7 or 8 dispensaries that are Black owned. Some of them are cooperatives and, you know, even better, you know, so it's a beautiful thing. But I still say that when you can, and if you can, support Black legacy, because these are obviously the folks who need it the most.
I hear you. And I completely agree. Could you envision an industry in Canada where legacy and legal coexist peacefully?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's tough, right? Because one will always see the other as a threat. The thing is, the funny thing is legacy will never see legal as a threat because we've always had to exist, or they've always had to exist. legacy's always had to exist on the underground, you know, with being more aware, being more, you know, you always have to be 10 steps ahead. You can't be operating where everybody else is operating, because then you're as good as gone, or you're done, or you're, you know, I hate to say it, busted, you know, or whatever, but it's ridiculous, you know, that we're even still having to worry about that, you know, police, whatever, Babylon, however you want to put it, you know, the fact that we're still running from that is ridiculous when it's celebrated in so many other circles, you know, and the only difference between that and the legacy is, you know, a few hundred grand and some suits. And that's really the truth.
So what's one solution that you would propose to make it easier for legacy people to become legal? What would be the one solution to reduce the barrier?
Yeah. So maybe something like they're already doing. You know, I'm definitely no genius. You know, a lot of my ideas come from what I've seen on the realm. Like, I had thoughts about it and verbalized it, and then found out that there were other states in the U.S. that were actually, you know, doing this. That were actually doing this and were, you know, putting it into place. So, like, for instance, California has what they call like an equity permit program, whereby they reserve a certain percentage of their permits for racialized and marginalized communities and communities that have been affected. I don't think that's unreasonable by any means, you know, making and creating some, just like the world has finally started to listen about BLM and, you know, other issues. And I'm not saying legacy is perfect either, because there's racism in the legacy industry too. I've battled some bullshit in the legacy industry too. So, you know, putting more resources for Black legacy companies, financial resources, you know, now that some banks are starting to back cannabis companies, and I heard it's a real sham because they're asking for really astronomical figures just to put in applications and stuff. So to me, that's just like another way of creating barriers and discriminating against certain folks. But
yes.
So the financial side is obviously where, you know, racialized communities differ the most. And if they can come up with some economic solutions that way, there are lots of things like grants. Why not grant money? Why not grant money for cannabis business? It's the number one traded stock in Canada. They're giving it that respect that way. Why can't they say, yes, we recognize that prohibition was a wrongdoing on behalf of the government, that we created a system to oppress racialized communities, and you know, we've corrected this, we're doing this, and to help show that, you know, we're going to be committed to creating more inclusive environment, we're going to do this, you know, we're going to give grants, startup grants for this, and mentoring if you want to, you know, engage in the legal industry, you know, or whatever, you know, that I don't want it to be necessarily for legal, because I want, like I said, I want legacy to be included. But if that's how they're going to do it, and they don't penalize legacy for having been involved in legacy, you know, in order to be included in legal, I know some of them are dropping their, you know, requirements, like, you know, you couldn't have had any cannabis convictions or whatever. Some of them are dropping all of that. And there are even companies that are starting to make an active effort to hire more people that have had cannabis convictions and are encouraging those who have had cannabis convictions to come forward. So that's a good thing. But, you know, the equity permit program and financial resources I don't want to say like lighter lending rules or lighter lending laws, but maybe more favorable lending laws for those from racialized communities, you know, specifically
maybe
Black,
yeah, and requiring less of a down payment or, you know, reduced fees, exactly, for marginalized communities.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you've got it. That's exactly what I was thinking of, something along those lines. Reduced interest rates as well, you know, maybe like options like deferred payments and things like that, you know, so that, you know, because the first few years are rough as well. So set them up for success, you know, and create these, you know, available options that would allow someone to ride out those rough spots and what have you, you know, where, you know, again, I hate to sound so general, but it is really the truth. You know, a lot of white companies, when they run into those situations and circumstances, they have folks they can call on. You know, the banks, not only are the banks more likely to approve them, but they probably have friends or family members or, you know, associates who are willing to jump in and help out more so because they have those resources and have had them for a long time. So it's not like something they're trying to hold on to. You know, there's a difference. There's a difference when you've had it and you've come from it versus when, you know, you've just acquired it and are trying to hang on to it, you know. And, you know, I hear people talk about, oh, well, you know, why don't, you know, Black businesses support Black communities and this and that. They do. But, you know, in case you haven't been noticing, you know, we're all struggling. You know, it's, yeah, just the conditions. And for those of us who are very successful too, you know, there's also a really, I don't want to say a burden, but, you know, it almost becomes, you know, you become the one person, not myself, you know, but like you become the one person that everybody goes to, you know, and then, you know, that one that was really well to do maybe is not as much as people think because they're actually supporting a lot of people.
Exactly. Exactly. So tell us, what prompted you to get into an offering infused dining? How did you get into that?
So, yeah, I was in the restaurant industry before. I've been in the restaurant industry for just, you know, just 10 over 10 years now, I guess. And like I said, I used to make little brownies and fudge and things like that for friends. And, you know, even I had staff ask me to make some stuff for them because they'd heard that it offers pain relief and what have you. So I started doing that. But then, you know, I thought, well, you know, why not like do bigger scale? You know, we do that. Anyways, it honestly was watching one of the Bon Appetit shows that really inspired me. And I, you know, before they were doing the regular stuff, they had like, I don't know, like some sort of a pilot show or whatever. Anyways, gave me the idea of doing it because I would do that anyways. Like, you know, we'd have parties and you'd bring stuff. So why not do an entire party that way? I cook. You know, I see that there's certain, you know, types of foods that people would tend to gravitate to, but I didn't really see anyone bringing the cultural aspect in. I was like, you know, I'd like to have my own food infused. I'd like to have an infused roti. I'd like to have, you know, I'd love to eat, be out somewhere where I couldn't smoke and pull out a roti and eat it. And to be able to get a nice buzz on, like that would be the best thing ever. So, you know, I started doing stuff like that, like my savory foods and, you know, called in a staff member and you know, Luke also helped too. And we, you know, I just tested out and, you know, learned dosing on my own. Like, so that was like a little over 10 years ago, kind of a thing. And the rest is history. Yeah. Yeah, I just decided to start I got into doing dinner parties and then events and catering.
I love it. I love it. So how have you managed to pivot during a global pandemic, Rena?
So it's been really hard, like really, really hard, because we had so much planned. We were weeks away from a canna crawl when everything happened, and I was knees deep in regular catering gigs and what have you. So all of that went away. You know, it's been really, really tough. I've kind of had to go back to some of my old school stuff. Like I said, you know, I've been doing doubles deliveries and, you know, just products. I actually, you know what? I didn't say that because it kind of prompted me into some other stuff. And I think I might've discovered something pretty cool. I started making some topicals that I needed for myself, like a deodorant, a chemical free deodorant. And then I needed a pain cream. So I was like, duh, you know, like I have oil and stuff. Why don't I make my own pain cream? Just make it like a really high dose and blah, blah, blah. So, you know, I did it similar to what I remember my grandmother doing. And like, I think I kind of discovered that it worked really well for me. I gave some to different friends and I was like, hey, you know, try this. Like, it's, you know, it's worked for me and blah, blah, blah. and people have gone crazy. I haven't even advertised it, and I'm actually sold out of it and need to remake more. It's been working really, like, really well for people. So, you know, I've just been having to reinvent myself every, like, I feel like almost every month. Like, I want to stay, you know, whatever, but it, like, it changes, you know, like this month it will be really busy with this, but then, like, it's been different because everyone's incomes have been up and down. Mine's been really down, but, you know, some folks have gotten CERB and the CERB gave a little bit of a boost here and there. And then CERB was pulled out for a lot of people. And then, you know, all of a sudden no one had any money. And then, so yeah, it's been a really, probably the toughest year in business I've ever been in. And like I said, I've literally been pulling from, you know, all different kinds of hats just to make ends meet. Yeah, I've pivoted quite a few times. Certainly it's been tough, but I think probably not uncommon. I happen to believe probably all of us have been doing quite a bit of that.
Absolutely. But, you know, there's a light at the end of the tunnel. And people are talking about the roaring 2022s coming. So I can't wait to see what is going to come next for the High Society Supper Club when we're past this this pandemic.
Okay, well, I certainly can't wait to get into more events. You know, people are waiting for another crawl. That's definitely going to be coming. But I cannot wait to get outdoors and do some great stuff. It's a lot of events in a nutshell. You know, I'm looking at doing a retreat kind of a thing. You know, more dinners, and just, you know, more things where we can gather and raise awareness, but definitely as we're growing in the industry, I'd like to see a lot more collaboration, and a lot more, you know, building and boosting the community. You know, we're coming through and we're slowly showing up. You know, we're getting there. We're getting there. And I think the sky is the limit for us, really. I can't wait to see where. So I keep, you know, I used to always talk about this being the opportunity for specifically Black and racialized communities to experience a paradigm shift, because we have an opportunity to get in here and do some things when things are very early. You know, we can create stuff that doesn't exist. We can fill needs that are not being met right now. You know, and if we're very creative, we can really create, sorry, without being a little bit tipsy, my words are wordy there, without, you know, we can really, you know, self-actualize a lot of stuff that would not only be beneficial to us, but, you know, I think to society on the whole. There's a lot of knowledge. We carry a lot of knowledge because we've been around this plant for more than 5, 10, 20 years even. You know, this has been in our culture for essentially thousands of years. And we can bring forth a lot. You know, it's just a matter of the legal industry really embracing that, you know, beyond wanting us to fit into, you know, whatever positions they've created for us. You know, did you hear that? It's my cat.
I love him. He wants to be part of the podcast.
You know, he does. I'm so happy he's on. I'm, you know, just looking forward to seeing what we will continue to achieve and aspire to in an industry that kept us out, that we essentially created. I'm really looking forward to that.
Me too. Now, switching gears, if someone were to gift you with an ounce of the finest weed available, what strain would you want it to be? And what would you do with it?
Ooh, the finest strain. The finest weed, best strain. Okay, let me think. I have so many favorites. I'm such a, like, I just like all flavors and all tastes. But let me think. Something nice and sticky, maybe something grape. I always like grape, you know, type, because, you know, those are usually heavier indicas. There's a nice deep flavor. Let me say, maybe something like a grape Gorilla Glue or something like that would be nice. But yeah, I just love everything. Like, there's so many nice new strains out there, like these ice cream and gelato strains and cake and, you know, all the orange strains, you know, the Mandarin and, you know, like all of that. It's just so good. Like, yeah, all the pink stuff too. And then there's so many berry things, but, yeah, maybe something like that. And then what would I do with it? Maybe make a nice strong oil. And that will be my nice strong oil. I like to make a strong oil that I could use topically or ingest or use for whatever I want. But that would be nice.
I love it.
Berries too.
Well, I love it. Thank you so much. And before I let you go, because it's been, you know, really great having you, I love talking to you. Could you tell our listeners one more time where they can reach you on social media?
Absolutely. So on Instagram, High Society Supper Club, I guess Facebook as well, but Instagram is really where we do most of everything these days. High Society Supper Club, you can also do highsocietysupperclub@gmail.com. We are on Facebook. If you just Google Rina, you can put my last name, Rampersad. If you can't spell it, that's good too. Rina, R-E-E-N-A, High Society Supper Club. You know, Rina Rampersad Hamilton, Rina Rampersad Cannabis. You'll get a bunch of stuff coming up, but to reach me directly, Instagram would be probably the best way.
Well, thank you so much for talking to me today and for sharing your journey. And it's been wonderful to hear it from you. So I really thank you. You've been so inspiring and I look forward to seeing what you come up with in the future. Thank you so much and stay lifted. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Miss Weed Wiki podcast, and we thank you for your support.